This is the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast brought to you by Art Wiederman, CPA with Ide Bailey. Whether it's taxes and investing or planning wisely, Art is the expert to make your dental practice profitable. At Ide Bailey, what inspires you inspires us. We provide a suite of accounting and advisory services dedicated to the total care of your practice. Visit our website to access our tools and resources tailored for dentists, idebailey.com/dentist. That's idebailey.com/dentist. This podcast is distributed with the understanding that Art Wiederman, CPA, and Ide Bailey, LLP are not rendering legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Listeners should consult with their business advisors before acting on any of the information or opinions shared. If you have questions and or feedback, make sure to email Art over at awiederman@idebailey.com. That's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N at E-I-D-E-B-A-I-L-L-Y.com. You can also give Art a call at 657-279-3243. Without further delay, here's your host, Dental CPA Art Wiederman.
And hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast with Art Wiederman, CPA. I'm your host, Art Wiederman. Welcome to the podcast. For those of you who are first-time listeners, welcome. I am a dental-specific CPA. September will be 41 years. I'm with the wonderful CPA firm of Ide Bailey. And, you know, one of the great things, like I've told you guys before who have listened to the podcast, is I get to hang out with a whole bunch of really wonderful, great, cool people. And I happen to have one of those wonderful, great, cool people today. And Jonathan Bonanno is... The guy is amazing. He's I had to practice this three times before I pronounce it. He's an industrial organizational psychologist. And what he does is really important for your dental practice. Is we want to make sure that in your office, you have a safe environment. We want to make sure that you hire the right people. We want to make sure you have a cohesive team. It's interesting in some of the preparation I did for this podcast, Jonathan's going to tell us why calling your team a family may not be the best thing for you. And I mean, you know, Jonathan has been in this profession for over a decade. I mean, he helps teams grow through innovative talent acquisition, organizational methods, and behavioral assessments. And those are way too big of words for me, so I'll stop there. We'll bring Jonathan on in a couple minutes, and we'll talk about everything organizational, everything team, and everything to make sure that a cohesive team is really important. I cannot tell you how many times in my 41 years of being a dental CPA that I have heard the story of, oh my gosh, we have a bad apple. We got rid of that bad apple. Now we have an amazing human at the front. And they get along with everybody, and our production has gone through the roof. So we'll get to Jonathan in a moment. Again, folks, we're in spring here, just after tax season. I hope all of you survived tax season, that you didn't get any big surprises from your CPA. But if you did, if your CPA is not dental specific and they don't do what you need them to do, and they don't know what the proper percentage for hygiene production is in the practice and the 4,000 codes, give me a call at 657-279-3243 or awiederman@idebailey.com. I want to thank my wonderful marketing partner, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine. Lorraine Kent and her team have been a big supporter. We're in our seventh year of this podcast. Go to www.decisionsindentistry.com for 140 amazing CE clinical courses for a very reasonable price. They have a new company called DDS Media Pro that helps doctors. Some of the marketing stuff they're doing for dentists, it just boggles my mind. Look for future announcements on our Business of Dentistry webinar series. We did the first one on April 23rd with Dr. Sherilyn Sheets and Ben Tuinay on PPOs, and Dr. Sheets talked about cracks and teeth. We will have the other ones coming up in the fall. And again, if you need some help, you want to just say hi, you have a suggestion for the podcast, 657-279-3243 or awiederman@idebailey.com.
Be sure to check out our new Ide Bailey podcast, Ebb and Flow, a business podcast providing inspired insight on issues and trends the middle market faces. Hear unique business stories, get answers to frequently asked and unasked questions, and understand business topics that matter to you. Available now on your favorite podcast platform.
All right, so let me get to my guest, Jonathan Bonanno. Again, Jonathan is an industrial organizational psychologist practitioner. He specializes in psychological safety, communication strategies, leadership, and organizational development. He helps teams grow through innovative talent acquisition, optimization methods, and behavioral assessments. Jonathan is all over the country presenting his seminars, and Jonathan won the 2024 Denobe Award. The Denobes are the premier awards ceremonies. I think they're in March of every year, put on by another friend of both ours, Melissa Turner. And Jonathan won the award for change and innovation. So some of the things that Jonathan talks about are create staggering roles for teams, transforming a comfort zone into a growth zone, thriving dental teams, banish fear and build trust, combative imposter syndrome, and transform your practice with trust and empathy. I don't know what all of those mean, but Jonathan, welcome to the Art of Dental Finance and Management. You're going to tell us all about this stuff, right?
That's right. That's right. Thank you so much for having me, Art.
Now, Jonathan, my understanding from our prior conversations is that besides being a really, really good coach, you've got some dance moves. You were a hip hop coach and you actually went on a dance competition for a TV show. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was a fun experience. A lot of the coaching methods and mechanisms and approaches that I use today are still very similar to the steps and routines that I used to create when I was in my teenage years. I grew up inside of the YMCA. My mom was the part-time sports director of the cheerleading program and the hip hop programs and the soccer programs. So my sister and I grew up inside of all aspects of that. But by the time I turned 13, I was an assistant hip hop coach in the program, designing and creating a lot of the routines, and then partnering with different venues inside of the city to get opportunities for us to go dance at or perform or whatever type of event was going on, like Mardi Gras or any parades in the city. It was a ton of fun. But I got the itch to go compete in a regional So You Think You Can Dance competition where they were touring Central California when I still lived here at that time. And I didn't make it through the finish line. You know, it was between ages 13 and 18, and I was like the first person to go out and dance. But hey, it got me on stage, which I think is allowing me to still be a lot more confident and comfortable on stages today.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're one of the happiest humans I've ever met. So I'll bet you just kill it on a dance stage. I was just in Mexico for my longtime neighbor's daughter's wedding. And by the way, if you ever get a chance to go to a wedding in Mexico, go. Because those people know how to throw a party. And I mean that in a very, very wonderful, kind way. I danced for 4 hours and my knees still hurt after a month. So, but I won't be going to compete in any dance competitions or I'll be looking for a divorce lawyer is what I've been told. But anyway, Well, anyway, Jonathan, let's get our conversation started. Tell us a little bit about your professional journey, kind of how you got to the work that you're doing today. I know you give us a little of your educational background and kind of what you did to get here.
Yeah, I would say, I followed a lot more of the non-conventional or untraditional pathway into dentistry. I started off in high school going to a very, I would say, predominant trade school essence, where we had a lot of different vocational programs built in. So you were able to tailor your high school education to essentially your college career and then onwards. So very early on, I created the roadmap to become a plastic surgeon. And throughout my courses, I started taking a lot of the HPA prerequisites for college. And then by the time I hit my senior year of high school, I was already dueling between multiple high schools here or in Arizona at the time. And it was a CNA by the time I graduated. Hated it. Absolutely hated it, and recognized very early on that clinically in healthcare was not going to be a forte for myself. I don't do odors. I can't do bodily fluids. Goriness just isn't for me. So knowing that that isn't going to be the solution for me.
Fainting in the middle of a surgery was not for you, right?
Exactly. Probably not the best person to come get your nose dropped from. So you might need another
one. I've been told I need one. Maybe you can refer me, but go ahead.
There you go. So during that time, I actually decided to take a year and a half off of college and go right to work and really understand, you know, what is going to be the side of business or working world is going to light me up. And I used to work with a company called McKesson. I worked with them for over 6.5 years. And then I immediately found my inkling, if you will, for the project space, for the people management and the development space. So I started with McKesson inside of their MPRS division, where I was responsible for a lot of the pharmacovigilance between the patient copay assistance programs for any of the brand name medications that were hitting the market, giving the opportunities for patients to, you know, have access to their medication without a $1,000 cloud essentially hanging over every time they needed a refill. I recognized very quickly that that type of conversation was very daunting. So I actually promoted out of that portion of the division of McKesson and moved into the MedSearch. So I led the field and national sales reps for all the West Coast and Midwest. And I essentially was like their spoke hub, if you will. So anytime that we were working with any of their clients, I was the one scheduling demos. I was the one checking on their orders. I was the one processing all the orders. Essentially operating as the administrator for all of these big field reps, which was amazing. And I loved it. I loved every aspect of that opportunity until they went fully remote. By this time, it was 2013, 2014. I was 18, 19 when I first started McKesson. So I didn't want to work from home right away. I was already working from home twice a week. So remote work was very, I would say, versatile for me at the time. But because of my age, I was not willing to cut myself off from the opportunities that would present themselves inside of our corporate office. So I then promoted out of that division and worked for risk evaluations and mitigation strategies, otherwise known as REMS. And anytime the FDA would release a medication, the risks of taking that product and medication, if they were deemed to outweigh the benefits of taking the drug, they would flag it as REMS. So I was one of the operations support leads, launching, deploying, and leading these implementations of these new products coming to market, specific to the REMS division. So I worked on two products, clozapine for severe schizophrenic patients, and then Nulogix for patients that were transitioning over or had just received a kidney transplant. So it was a lot of fun. I loved the operational world side of it. It gave me a lot of insight to the type of leader that I wanted to be, to the type of team that I wanted to create, and really the type of culture that I was going to either contribute to or be responsible for shifting and changing. I had a great example of what toxic leadership looked like inside of those positions, and it allowed me to really position myself to move out of that department as well. So promoted out again, I became a business process analyst over all the implementations that were coming into our reimbursement hub in the state of Arizona, as well as in Ohio. So as a BPA, I was overseeing all of the tech stacks, the system deployments, the staffing agencies, the organizational infrastructure, the user acceptance testing, the user experience testing, the Salesforce and user story writing. So I used to develop a lot of software inside of a lot of the quality assurance monitoring I would do, and then any other forms of partnership with the other departments. I was then recruited out of that department and pulled into our C-suite and started working more closely and intimately in the implementation capacity. So by the time I left McKesson, I was an implementations consultant manager overseeing all of the implementations coming in from Novartis and Merck, a handful of other drugs like Sanofi, Johnson & Johnson, some of the other product lines that we were responsible for overseeing. But I got to a point inside of my career at McKesson, where, you know, I was able to get my bachelor's, my master's degree taken care of while I was with them too, because of all their tuition reimbursement, which was great. So my undergrad and graduate is completely geared towards business administration, business management, and all of the aspects that live within that world. But I got to the point at the very end of my career with McKesson where I recognized that, you know, values mean a lot to me. And when we're walking in a hallway where our value system from a corporate responsibility perspective are smacked everywhere, the terms, the labels, the pictures, but it's not really a lived-in experience, it became very much work. And it wasn't work that I was inspired by or excited to do anymore. So I really took a step back and really started looking at, you know, what really is kind of the next step of the corporate ladder that I'm climbing, which was really just to make more money and get a couple extra acronyms either in front of my business title or not, but still working in the same environment, still working with the same people, still working with the same clients and vendors. There was no more further expansion for me. So at that time, I was actually recruited by my husband, Michael. He had owned practices in the state of Arizona. After selling his shares in the offices, he had launched his own consulting agency, got into the transitions business. And if you know Michael, he is super business guy. And as he was building and scaling his organization, his team was growing as well. So he actually approached me and asked me to step in as his COO and build out his operations and HR division, along with acquire all of the team and begin managing and developing them. So as you can imagine, this guy coming from technology, life sciences, medical, pharmaceuticals, has no lick of understanding of what's going on in the dental world. However, the only angle that I've always looked at things is the lens of continuous improvement. So as I stepped into the COO position, I was dually operating as a practice management consultant, working within our consulting offices while simultaneously building out our virtual entities for how we were positioning our practices to sell. And how we were positioning our practices to sell was through the integration of virtual talent and virtual teams. But while I was working and understanding all of the ins and outs of dentistry and working in practices, going between the different locations, I simultaneously shifted our model as a consulting agency into more of a non-managed DSO partnership product, to where we were connected and partnered with a lot of offices around the state of Arizona, just working as essentially their hub for any type of resources and support that they were looking for from HR, operations, vendors, sales, business development, marketing, everything and anything that you could think of, we were responsible for creating that. But I also recognized very early on that in order for me to grow and be an effective dental leader at now at this time, I needed a little bit more intimate exposure to the conversations at play. So I actually stepped into one of our clients' offices and created an opportunity to position her to sell her practice inside of the timeline that she was looking for, if she was willing to help bring me on as her office manager and train me everything about dentistry. By day three, I was working in a cosmetic office, high fee for service. We had a couple of PPO patients and we had an associate that was our PPO provider. By day three, I was trucking away in Dunch Tricks, check, credit, or charge. How are we getting this full mouth restoration taken care of for you?
You're ingrained in dentistry.
Yeah, exactly. So ever since then, that was one of the most, I would say, grateful opportunities that I've experienced inside of dentistry, is having that type of education that you can't put a price on. And the relationship and the trust and the safety and the presence of team, like that team is someone that I consistently reference. I still talk to the older owner doctor that had sold the practice because she was my mentor. She was my coach. She was there when I had, you know, my own personal stuff that I was dealing with. And then COVID reared its ugly head at that time. So it was quite challenging.
You didn't like virtual. That was all virtual. Yeah, I remember COVID. I think we all remember COVID. So, Jonathan, you are an industrial organizational psychologist. By the way, that's a wonderful story. And it's amazing how you kind of went from the medical field and kind of tracked into the dental field. I don't, having gotten to know you a little bit, I don't see you as a big corporate guy. I kind of see you as someone doing your own thing. And that makes a lot of sense. Tell our audience, what is an industrial organizational psychologist?
Yeah, so to break it down in the simplest terms, industrial psychology is significantly much more performance-driven. So we're looking at KPIs, we're looking at understandings of goals, metrics, standards of practice. if we flip it on the other side, the organizational psychological lens is more people geared. So we're looking at motivators, drive, desires, empowerment, growth, culture, all of those aspects that are much more people-centered to ensure that the organizational goals are being accomplished. So I get to bridge all of the people science inside of my approach into my conversations because it's important. And that's something that I recognized early on inside of my project management world and implementation spaces. It's one thing to meet a timeline, but it's one thing to meet a timeline and be happy about meeting it. So needing to get deeper into the psyche of the person was really what inspired me to pursue a doctoral education in IO psychology.
So in your work, and we're going to talk about kind of two areas of your work today, Jonathan. One of them is communication with patients, and the other is primarily we're going to talk about is communication with the dental team. So let's start off. I mean, in preparing, I learned that it's not only communicating with patients, but also understanding the employees' needs and preferences to create a positive work environment. So let's start with the patient communication. Why don't you give our listeners a little bit of insight and some tips into better communication with patients?
Absolutely. When I always think about communication is never about us. It's never about the sender. It is always about the receiver. And oftentimes we need to reposition ourselves and reframe our conversation internally to prepare for that external dialogue to take place. So whether you're speaking with a patient, a customer, whomever that's coming into your presence that you're going to be interacting with, it's taking the time to actually be positioned to listen more. And I say that because it's not just to say like, oh, you need to have active listening or you need to know when to respond. There is a lot of art inside of being patient and being present for the conversation that needs to take place. And it's also important to be sure that that person is in the space for that conversation to take place. And oftentimes, when we're not present for that, or even clear, or even asking for that level of permission, it creates the opportunity for miscommunication to take place, as well as misconception for what the conversation is truly about. So when I start thinking about what is the conversation between maybe me, the office manager, talking to the patient, and this is their first experience in our practice, well, my opportunity there is to ensure that the patient feels comfortable, feels seen, and is going to feel acknowledged inside of understanding why they're there for their care. Whether it's me getting up to greet them, that was one thing that I always made sure to do is if a patient walked into the room, I'm not sitting down at my desk, in my chair, I'm standing up and I'm acknowledging their presence. So when I'm doing that, I'm making sure that we're building some level of rapport, some level of connection, even inside of the unspoken communication tactics that might come into play. If your head's down and a new patient's walking into the practice and you're on the phone with insurance or you're diddling on your whatever report that you just printed off and you're like, oh, hey, how's it going? And then you're back to doing what you're doing, that starts creating the experiential shift in your office in that single instance, whether you're present for it or not, or even aware about it. But that plays a huge significant emotional factor inside of what type of buyer you're going to experience today. Personal experience as a shopper, if I go into, let's say, Lululemon, I know that if I went to the Lululemon inside a Fashion Square, I'm not going to be acknowledged there. It's rude. It's a different experience. But if I go to the Lululemon that's down the street from my house here in San Diego, the vibe, the energy is much more open. It's much more willing. So if you start thinking about if you as a shopper are going in and if they're not being somebody to greet you, acknowledge you or anything, 9 times out of 10, you're probably not going to buy something from there. And it's because of the experience you just had with that first encounter. So there's a lot of conversations around like the DOFI, right? Director of First Impressions. I like to challenge it and say that it needs to be a DALI, a Director of Lasting Impressions. So what is the first experience you're going to be responsible for creating that's going to be the lasting impression inside of that next exchange or the continuous exchange? Because that patient chose to go to you. And they can choose to go somewhere else too.
Exactly. Now, you spent a good part of your career before you got into dental, Jonathan, in medical. And I can't tell you how many times I've gone into a medical office where someone opens the door, yells my name out, Art Wiederman, and they turn around and walk and they expect you to follow us. I'm assuming that's not how you teach the dental team to greet patients, right?
Not at all.
And I'm sure you saw some of that. I'm sure you were in one or two medical offices in your career, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
It's very scary. I don't mean to beat on the medical profession because some of my best friends are physicians, But that's what happens sometimes. So, so those are some really great tips. I want to spend a lot of our time today, Jonathan, talking about team cohesiveness and effectiveness. And as I mentioned at the beginning, in my opening, in my interactions with Dennis, I always hear the word family. And that sounds wonderful. Mm-hmm. We're a family. We're a big, happy family. Hugs, kisses, all that stuff. And that sounds good. But, you know, I was reading some of your stuff and your blogs, and you're saying, well, I don't know about that. Talk about that. Why is family maybe not the best way to refer to your team?
I have strong opinions about this. And
it's, well, that's why you're here. We want to hear them.
Yeah. So between this term and the rock star term, those are like my no-no words. But when we think about the word family, families can be extremely functional and extremely dysfunctional. They can create the space for scapegoats, for gossiping, for subgrouping, for any other negative experience that you have personally have had inside of your family is something that can translate into the family that gets created inside of the team construct that is necessary. And what I mean by that is, it's great to have familial experiences and familial values. I mean, you want that level of connectedness and the safety, the trust, and all of those things, right? That family does bring. However, when you've put and pigeonhole and position yourself into, we are just a family, we all have to get along, that doesn't create opportunity for safety and debates and constructive conversations to take place. I don't know about anybody else or any of our listeners, but I've had it in conflict with family members before, and it's gotten into conversations to where, you know, maybe I just don't need to talk to this cousin anymore because we're just not aligned. And that's important to recognize because we are still individual humans. We have individual value systems, individual belonging cues, and that naturally occurs and shows up. But when we hear the thing about like, well, blood's thicker than water, that shows up inside of the family conversation. So what type of blood is thicker than water are you actively creating within your team and cultural environment? The way that I look at it from a team perspective is, consider you're hiring a new team member today and you're operating from the family space. How engaged are you looking to be with a newfound cousin that you never knew that you had, but you've been going to the family reunion every single day, and this is the family that you've been aware of, you know, you trust, you're all the things, right? We're on guard when we're introducing a new individual. We're not as open and vulnerable or as authentic as we choose to be because why? We are now on stage. We're either going to give them all the good stuff that they're going to experience as they're coming into their first couple of days, or they're going to experience all the bad and negative stuff of what this family has in terms of the values, the behaviors, all the things that then show up inside of those conversations. So I am anti-referring to the team as a family. I think if you were to refer to having family as maybe a value, a way of being, a conversation that shows up in maybe huddles, as opposed to referring to, we are a family here, we all get along until we don't. And it's just like, okay, let's look at how do we actually effectively operate as a team and hyper-focus on the fact that we are a team working towards a common goal. We are up to something. We are working towards something. We are making sure that the patient experience is going to be better than the last patient just experienced it. We're going to make sure that we're closing more treatments today than the ones that we did yesterday. We're going to be educating more about our patients on the importance of perio maintenance and all the other great products that are out there for hygiene. Those become initiatives that you get to target and focus on. And then you get to choose how you create that space for that. But when you focus so predominantly on the family construct, people don't get along. And oftentimes when I'm coming into practices to work inside of correcting or conflict resolution, it's because of that family terminology has been ingrained so deeply that I don't get it. I don't understand why they're doing this. We're supposed to be a family. Because you're not having conversations. You're not having the real raw discussions necessary.
We should really be a team and not a family because we are running a business. We can be friendly, right? So how do you undo, if it's all, you know, family, kiss, kiss, hug, hug, how do we undo that? And do you undo that in the work that you do?
Yeah. So it's a big part of the undoing. So if we look at like maybe like a scraggly maybe look at this little squiggly thing here, right? Yeah. If this is all knotted up behind me, it's finding the pieces to start pulling it out until it's straightened out. And sometimes we recognize that maybe that there is just an echo chamber taking place, and we're needing to get to the root cause of either who's the initiator or instigator of the discussion or dialogues, or is it really just how the environment has been cultivated? And if that's how the environment's been cultivated, then we have to reset the foundation. And that's why I speak so heavily on psychological safety, because culture to me is an outcome. If you don't have safety or trust or authenticity being present, you're never going to be going uphill as if you're pushing, or you're always going to be going uphill pushing a boulder. It's never going to get to the point where it's creating that snowball effect where it's a just easy roll down the hill. So that's where I like to tackle it from that lens. I like to have a lot more one-on-one conversations, and then I incorporate a lot of talk therapy into those discussions to see where's the issue? Is it them? Is it you?
Yeah, in a second, we're going to jump into the psychological safety, because I know that's a big part of your work. Right now, I want you to talk a little bit to our listeners about what you do, how you might be able to help them. Again, this is going to be coming out in late May of 2025, maybe where you might be. And tell our listeners what you do and how they can get a hold of you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm an industrial organizational psychologist. I'm an executive consultant in KOL for a handful of organizations and brands. I work very predominantly with, of course, dental professionals and dental organizations. But the best way to get in contact with me or to work with me is through Chief Psycho. That is the brand that is all of my education and my professional work that's tied to what I do in dentistry. Other aspects is Talent by Zia. So Zia is the organization that I lead with my team sprinkled around the country and the world, where we focus on everything related to talent optimization, whether it's virtual talent integration or talent optimization for workplace development or organizational growth. So we work with a lot of great individuals there, whether they are dental practices, consultants, entrepreneurs. We get to help support and see their visions come to life, which is something that I love. I love to build. So I love to see the opportunities for others really show up for themselves. And the best way you can get a hold of me is either jb@chiefpsycho.com or jb@talentbyzia.com. Those are my direct communication pathways, and happy to chat and answer any questions as it relates to virtual talent and conscious coaching.
And we'll put, thank you, Jonathan. We'll put that in the show notes. I want to get back to talking about psychological safety, which is a lot of what your work is about. What is psychological safety, and why is it important in a dental office?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always love to break psychological safety down as a culture of rewarded vulnerability. And what I mean by that is, if we were to look at the aspects of safety, it's really the space and making sure that you feel like you can be your fully authentic Jonathan or Art inside of the work that you do. Do you feel safe inside of your environment? Do you feel at ease inside of your environment? Are you lit up, inspired, and fulfilled inside of your work? Or are you nervous? Are you anxious? Do you dread coming to work? Do you dread speaking to your team? Do you dread speaking to your leader or your dentist or whomever it is in that leadership capacity? And psychological safety creates the opportunity for these types of conversations to actually develop inside of the organization, inside of the practice. So when I look at psychological safety, it was originally introduced by Professor Amy Edmondson from Harvard, and it was based on understanding workplace dynamics. How do people actually promote and grow and create opportunities for change inside of their workplace? And one of the avenues that she found inside of her research was the fact that whether or not people feel safe or trust the people that they work with. And my big tagline under my Chief Psycho brand is improving workplace health and behavior. So how do we do that? And it's getting to the individual understandings and getting to understand, you know, who is Jonathan or who is Art at the core? What lights you up? What inspires you? What motivates you to come to work every day? And what are you doing now that would allow you to be the better version of yourself in the future, if that's what you're looking for in terms of growth, opportunities, and development? What I love about psychological safety, though, is that it's consistently becoming a continuous conversation of practice. I'm a member of the Society of Industrial Organizational Psychology, so I follow a lot of the research and work that's coming into the market today. And a lot of it has been, I would say, again, referencing back to COVID, it's been ignited really heavily to ensure that people are actually feeling good and fulfilled inside of the work that they do. It was then later introduced by Dr. Timothy Clark, where he broke down four factors of psychological safety that really allow you to step into the space or identify the space that needs work to be done. And that stands, it goes back to learner safety, contributor safety, challenger safety. And there was one more. It'll come back to my head. But inside of those conversations, we're able to really understand whether or not we're actually present inside of those discussions. For instance, learner safety is you want to make sure that you can ask questions. Are you in an environment where you can actually have feedback and discussions? Or is it every time you raise an idea, it's shot down? So when we start looking at understanding the psychoanalytics behind that, we can then start rebuilding the framework and foundation on the foundation of psychological safety being present. So that way it acts as a precursor to how you're developing trust with your team.
So Jonathan, in that realm, talk about whose responsibility is it to create the psychologically safe workplace? I'm assuming that it's the leader, the doctor, the owner, and then maybe talk about how the team is supposed to keep that workplace psychologically safe.
Yeah, absolutely. So I always, the leader has a role in it, right? The fish stinks from the head. So you gotta look at ways to make sure it's not stinky anymore.
I heard that one in a while. Okay, go ahead.
So having the conversations there and understanding what type of business are they leading, are they trying to run, and then determining whether or not they do actually have the right team that's going to support and maintain that overall mission and objective that you're working towards. But to be quite honest, everybody has the opportunity to be responsible for creating the level of safety that they want to experience. And that's where you get to operate as a change agent. So if you don't feel safe in your role or don't feel safe with your leader or your team, that's an opportunity for a discussion. It's a difficult conversation to have, but it's a conversation worth having because that weight is going to be off of your shoulders almost immediately. So having the opportunity to look at it from the leadership perspective, it's built on your value system, it's built on your goals, it's built on your direction. So that needs to be communicated, not just verbally, but physically, emotionally understood. So in times of despair, when family is all you've known or have, and then a breakdown occurs, you need to be ready to know what to do inside of those areas of contention, really. And then on the team side, they're responsible for maintaining the level of safety that they want to experience too. Just because leadership isn't in your title doesn't mean that you're not equipped to lead. So when you have this, I would say, level of insight or level of awareness, you have the responsibility to change the entire experience of your team as well. I could be a dental assistant in the back office working with our associate provider, and I feel like I may not have a say, but I still have ears and I still have eyes, and I'm not going to allow things or people to go unacknowledged or be dismissive or be dismissed in a way that doesn't allow them to be seen and heard. That's my opportunity to be like, hey guys, we're cutting down on maybe, I don't know, a value system is teamwork. We're not honoring our teamwork value right now, and we need to restore the integrity in what teamwork looks like. Let's actually sit down and understand what teamwork means on this team.
Yeah, I think it's so important, Jonathan, that the leader, the owner doctor or owner doctors, if it's a multiple doctor practice, create an environment where everybody is comfortable walking into the doctor's office and saying, yeah, doctor, I'd like to talk to you about something. Because in a lot of businesses, I'm sure you saw this when you were at McKesson and medical and now dental, is they're for, oh my God, if I bring this up or if I make trouble, I'm going to get fired. And do you see that a lot too?
Oh yeah, all the time. And that's unfortunate because that just goes to show that safety isn't present. It's just been, you get scolded for poor behavior, yeah, or poor production. Yeah. And that's how you lose some of your high achievers and your high performers, because the only way that they know how to exit, if they don't have the tools to communicate, is to exit.
Now, I know, Jonathan, you also talk about in your work the vibe of a team, V-I-B-E. So what are some signs that a dental team's vibe might be off, and is it fixable, and how do we fix it?
Yeah, I would say it's always fixable. There's always a solution. you know, the vibe is off when people are not even saying hello in the morning. I know, as simple as it sounds, but I've walked through so many practices where people don't even acknowledge their team. They don't even say good morning. I'm somebody that when I would walk into my practice, I gave fist bumps every day. And that was just be like, hey, good morning. What's up, guys? How you doing? How's breakfast? How's your family? Like, it was quick instances just to get connected. And there are so many practices that don't even do that. And if they're going into their morning huddles, I've seen people roll their eyes. I've seen them cross their arms. You know, body language is a language in itself. So that is a huge tell-all for the vibe of your team, the vibe that you're creating. Also how your patients come in too. I mean, I have seen a lot of misalignment in terms of what the doctor had seen their practice to be, to what the team that they have, to the type of patients that they're attracting. And none of it is in alignment. So then you question and wonder, and then the doctor is like, well, why can't I get new patients? Why can't we convert treatment? Why, right? It's because all of that stuff is just completely miswound. So when you start seeing that as well, you start seeing that trickle into experiences and conversations, into whether or not you're actually enjoying the work or enjoying the people you're working with. And then gossiping happens, then arguing happens, then subgrouping happens, then siloed communication happens. Oh, I'm the expert and I know everything, so don't worry about the SOP for this. Just come to me and talk to me about it. That doesn't help. That doesn't help train. That doesn't help develop sustainability. It creates siloed crutches for individuals in the practice. So those are big tell-alls for me. I like to go and have very candid one-on-one conversations. I listen more and talk very less in these dialogues, because then that helps me kind of paint a picture for not just the individual, but paint the picture of what's to be experienced. And maybe there's some other areas that I need to turn over.
So I'm assuming, Jonathan, you've walked into dental offices, and I'm sure you've walked into many of them, where you can tell a bomb is about to go off in the next 30 seconds. We just don't know who's going to set it off. So when you have a situation like that, we know, you and I, that the leader is the one that is probably allowing that to happen, and the leader has to stop it. So how do we create a good team culture? I mean, we have this tense situation where nobody's saying hello to each other and everybody's got their heads down, and the tone of voice is not good, and the patients can tell it, and the vendors can tell it, and the team can tell. How do we fix that? What do we do? Do we have to clean house? What does the owner have to do?
Yeah. So sometimes yes. Sometimes it's a matter of just coming together and having a very raw, deep dialogue. And I've done both. So on one side where it required replacement, or I would say termination, I was working with a practice and the hygiene team was not getting along. One of the hygienists was promoted to the hygiene team lead. Two of the hygienists were sisters. And then the oddball out was a new hygienist that joined the practice about a year to 2 years less than the others had been in the practice already. The newer hygienist, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, bringing in all the education and learning that they've had, was rubbing all the seasoned hygienists very, very incorrectly, to the point where it became an us versus them conversation, or us versus me conversation. So all three hygienists positioned themselves to walk out the practice if this hygienist was not terminated and left. Fortunately, puts the doctor in a very difficult position, a rock in a hard place. So then we have to start looking at performance. Okay, so based off of the uproar that's happening with the emotional triggers taking place, what actually is the performative measures that we're actually looking at to determine what needs to happen inside of these conversations? Well, after doing some digging, we found that the new hygienist was actually poking the bear intentionally, causing some havoc intentionally, causing some issues with the other hygienists intentionally. That was then the uproar effect of it's us versus her type of conversation. So we had to go back and really start looking at what were all the reports, what were the conversations, so we could start documenting it, making sure that we're not creating, you know, an unlawful or untermination that takes place. So ultimately, we had to create a separation with the newer hygienist and found a new opportunity to position her in a practice that was going to really value the education and learning that she was eager to bring to the opportunity that she had, but also be responsible for correcting the behavior of the other three hygienists for how they acted. And what we did is go through a communication workshop. And knowing how to actually communicate things and being available and open for feedback was one of the biggest issues that they were really experiencing. And feedback is always a scary thing. People say that they're open to it, but then once they hear it, they're like, I didn't need to hear that. I'm pretty good. Yeah, right? Yeah. We might go into our default space.
So in your situation that you were discussing here, there was fault on both sides is what you're telling me, right?
Absolutely.
So sometimes there's fault on both sides. Sometimes there's fault with the leader who's not creating the environment that there can be open conversation. Talk for a minute about recognizing achievement in a team and why that's important.
It is very important. And this is something that I learned later than I would have liked to. And I say that because as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, I'm constantly looking for the next thing and I'm constantly moving towards the next thing. That it becomes very difficult, not difficult. It's difficult to slow down to acknowledge some of those little milestones of accomplishment, of achievement, of awards, whatever it is. And when you actually slow down to really be present with that, I have seen so much more, I would say, excitement and momentum, both personally inside of myself for the next work or next project that I get to work on. But when you see that in someone else, that lights me up even more. And I led a workshop last year with one of my business partners, Sarah Cottingham, and I was bawling in the room watching literally somebody that stepped into the weekend over the weekend or over the retreat that weekend. That was this tiny shell of a person that didn't see the worth in themselves, didn't see the resilience that they had, wasn't present to the amount of power and education that they brought to the table. That by the end of the weekend, this woman was facilitating conversations, leading dialogues, ready to get in and get raw inside of the nitty-gritty discussions that were necessary, calling people out and holding them accountable. And it's those moments that inspire me to keep me doing what I do. But it's those moments that people that don't recognize that they have so much to them that they get to really bring outside of them that everybody else is busy watching and looking at you, waiting for it to happen, that you then get to be responsible for celebrating that coming out of them. And that's why I believe there should be so much more celebration inside of conversations in the practice. Whether it's something simple, like it doesn't need to be always work-related too. I think that's the other thing is like, sure, I talk about you don't need to be a family, but you can still be friendly with your team. So, congratulations, you just built that patio door that you were working on for the last couple days or couple weeks. Simple, right? It doesn't need to be like, oh my goodness, I just went on stage and won an award and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, now celebrate me. I don't know. How about we celebrate all of the accomplishments that have led you to the opportunity for you to even be a potential recipient? Like, take the step back and acknowledge that, celebrate that, be present with that.
I remember when I led a team for 33 years, and I would always, my door was always open. I was always friendly to people. I never became their best buddies. I didn't socialize with them, which that can get you in trouble too, obviously. But at the end of the day, you know, my people were comfortable and we would celebrate. We had a situation in our office where I might've mentioned this on a podcast way back. And one of my team members, her family was from the Philippines. And she was a very wonderful human being, but timid. And my partner walks in and because she was more comfortable talking to the partner and said, you know what? She has to go back because her dad is dying. And it was the dead of tax season. And she was my main tax preparer. She says, what do you want to do? And I said, without trepidation, let's get the team into my office. Let's have this conversation. Hey, guys, we got this problem. And they all knew it. I said, she needs to leave. How are we going to get all this work done? And I think that was a good thing. Those are the types of things that a leader does. So I want to get on a little bit about, you know, leadership You talk in your blogs about different styles. Let's start with autocratic and democratic. I mean, I'm sure that in your work, Jonathan, you evaluate the different styles that of leadership. And so talk about, let's start with autocratic and democratic. What's good? What's bad? How do they work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing around the leadership styles and like approaches and constructs is that we look at them as if they're a bad thing or if one is greater than the other. And what I look at it as is, you know, there's areas to pull on from both. When it comes to an autocratic leader, you know, this is somebody that is more individualistic. They are leading and not really having collaborative discussions in the sense of where the decisions need to be made. If I'm the leader and if I'm responsible for it, I might be taking full and complete ownership of whatever outcomes that are going to come as a result of that decision. Whereas the democratic style is significantly more collaborative. You are looking for collaborative decision-making. You're looking for buy-in. You're looking for alignment. You're looking for understanding and joint understanding, I would say. But there's avenues for both. Like I will constantly pull on both constructs of autocratic and democratic leadership style, because the way that I look at it is collaborative discussions don't always lead to collaborative decision-making. And there is still somebody that needs to make the decision. There's still somebody that needs to be responsible for making that decision. So knowing when to be autocratic and democratic inside of your dialogues or even the individual you're working with, it's important. It's important not to just pigeonhole yourself, though, into saying, oh, I'm an autocratic leader and this is what I'm hunkering down into. You can 100% do that. However, it will rob you from other styles of leadership constructs that you can pull on to be a little bit more agile and flexible inside of the individual that you're leading or looking to influence followership from.
See, I think Jonathan, I want to hear what you think about this, is I think that the leader needs to say to the team, hey guys, here's the deal. Okay. I need your help. I always like asking for help. I need your help. Now, understand, guys, a couple things. Number one, I will always listen to your input. Number two, I will not always agree with your input, and I will not always implement what you're asking me to do, because somebody has to be the leader. But my team, I mean, has, whenever I had a big decision, and I just didn't, you know, I said, guys, what do you think? And they understood that I made the final decision, and they have to honor the leader's final decision, right, Jonathan? So maybe combination of these. There's some other leadership styles you talked about. Is you've got laissez-faire leadership. Give me my lunch, my handpiece, and my paycheck, and leave me alone. I'm sure you see that too. How does that work?
Yeah. So the laissez-faire leader, aka the lazy leader. No, I'm just kidding.
The non-leader. No, you're not kidding. You're right.
Yeah. So this. The laissez-faire leadership style is one that does not work for me, personally, development-wise, all the things. And this was because I had firsthand experience working with somebody that really operated and really was a laissez-faire leader. And the way that I look at it as, it can be effective if it's systematic and there's an approach that's actually methodical. But when it is exactly what you just shared of like, do as I say, don't do as I do, it's very hands-off. It becomes a dictatorship. It becomes very much not an incubation of resources and innovation. It becomes just dread and despair. And it becomes very toxic very easily, especially when you're wanting to work somewhere that you're looking to get development from, but the leader itself that's responsible for developing you has zero interest because of their own either personal interests and aspirations that they have. You know, that's what I experienced as a laissez-faire leader that I had, was they weren't interested in developing the team. They were interested in how they were going to be developed and move on to their next opportunity and screw everyone else. So it was like, okay, well, that doesn't work for me.
Corporations sometimes. Yep. I agree.
Yeah.
Now, the last couple leadership styles are the ones that I like the most. I was reading about on your blog is a transformational leader, where we're inspiring and motivating, and especially a servant type of a leader, where we're serving the needs of others. And in healthcare, especially in dentistry, I mean, what I always tell my you know, when I tell a new, when I'm a dental practice broker and I sell dental practices, and every once in a while I get an opportunity to have a closing meeting where I get to address the buyer. And I say, Dr. Buyer, okay, everything that you do must be in the best interest of your patient. And the money will come. And it doesn't matter if you have to take an action and you don't get paid for it. So talk a little bit about the transformational leader and the servant leader, because I kind of think if I were a betting man, that's kind of where you're pushing a lot of your clients to go in their leadership styles.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the clients that I work with, they're very entrepreneurial spirited. And what I love about it is there's so much conviction and passion for what it is that they're at work on or whatever it is that they're responsible for causing. So when I pull on the aspects of transformational and servant leadership styles, it's really almost molding and blending it with also aspects of agile leadership. And then I really speak heavily more on the psychodynamic side of the leadership. So then I bundle it up so it can really occur as a very heart-centered approach. You know, when you look at the transformational style of leadership, it really is the essence of transformation. What are you looking to change? What are you looking to influence? What are you looking to be responsible for creating? And that is not just in terms of value of product, but that is in value of feelings and experiences with the people that you're rubbing shoulders with. And having the ability to transform even just a perspective of someone's thinking, that's beautiful. And that's an opportunity to celebrate too. And that's why I love that style so much is, and I think that a lot of people resonate with it. And I think it's gotten a little loosey-goosey in terms of how it's actively defined. However, if you're really committed to the transformation of another individual, transformational leadership is the definite style that you should be looking and doing your research on and understanding whether or not it fully resonates with you. And servant leadership, it's being service. You know, we are in a service industry. We are in the space of servicing patients that are needing care. We are in the space of servicing clinicians that are looking for support, resources, education, tools, technology necessary to provide that care to patients. And if we actually took that step back a little bit further and recognize that we are in service of, I'm in servitude of something at a greater cause without it being spiritual or woo-woo or whatever other thing that you want to resonate with, there is a place for you to be in service of yourself while still servicing other individuals. And that's where I find so much resonance with the team constructs around servant leadership style, because again, it's not about me. It's about how can I do better to support you? What can I do for you? And in turn, it makes me feel good, of course, but the action, I would say, of going into service is not to be from a selfish position. It's to be in the space of servicing others. Which is why I love those models and the value systems that come with it too, because you get to change and alter and grow them as you need to, as the individual leader that you are. Pull on the constructs that apply to the situation or apply to how it is that you want to be positioning yourself in today's workplace.
Right. And the doctors are the way they are and they're going to do what they need to do. But doctors, I'm going to tell you this, 41 years in this profession, I have been in probably over 1,000 dental offices. I've talked to thousands of dentists in my lectures and podcasts. And here's what I've learned is if your team is dysfunctional, you will not have a successful dental practice. That's my opinion. It's end of discussion. I think Jonathan will agree with me. So if you guys wake up and you listen to this podcast and you wake up the next morning, you go, you know, he hit a point that I've been thinking about for a long time. You might want to give my friend Jonathan a call because, I mean, you can turn practices around with this work, can't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the results are easily maintained afterwards and easily for new team members to step into to experience from the get-go.
All right. Well, I would love to talk to you for another 3 hours as I do with every one of my guests, but unfortunately, that is not going to happen today. So Jonathan, last time, would you please give out your contact information? Doctors, if your practice isn't doing well, it's not because of the economy. It's not because people don't need dental work. It's not because of all those things. There's a very good chance it's because your team is not in the right place. And this young man, Jonathan Bonanno, and I don't I don't get anything for saying this about any of the guests I have on here, but Jonathan is a nationally recognized expert in this area. And if you're having team issues, you might want to give him a call. Give out your contact information.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Art. Yes, you can reach out to me at jb@chiefpsycho.com or jb@talentbyzia.com. Those are my direct emails. Either way, they're going to come to me, so you'll get a hold of me.
Sounds good. Jonathan Bonanno, hang with me as I take the podcast out. Thank you for your great insight. I mean, we need more people in our dental profession to help our doctors because this is one of the main issues that we see. Can you fix getting new patients? Sure. If you have a place that people want to come to, they'll refer their friends. If you have a place that, oh my God, I walked in there and it was like a war zone, they're not going to refer their friends. And I don't care how much money you spend on marketing and how good your website is and how good your social media is. So anyway, all right, just hang with me as I take this out. Again, folks, thank you for the honor and privilege of allowing me to come into your home, into your iPhone, into your tablet, or however you listen to me. I love doing this work. I love working with people like Jonathan Bonanno who help the dental profession. If you need any help on the accounting or tax side, my team is as good as it gets. Call me at 657-279-3243. If you are looking for a new CPA or if you're looking for one that understands dentistry, or email me at awiederman, that's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N @idbailey.com. I'm also a member of the Academy of Dental CPAs, 25 CPA firms across the United States that represent over 11,000, probably up to 12,000 dentists by now. And I love this group. They're like my family. If you are looking for great clinical content, Decisions in Dentistry magazine is the place to go. 140 continuing education courses at a very, very reasonable price. Best clinical content on the planet. Go to www.decisionsindentistry.com. Jonathan Bonanno, keep doing what you're doing because our dentists need your help. They really do.
Thank you, Art. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
All right. And folks, again, thank you for listening. Please tell your friends. Please subscribe to the podcast on all of the different avenues that you can, such as Apple and Spotify and all those places that I don't think I'll ever understand, but I know that's where it is. And with that, this is Art Wiederman for the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast with Art Wiederman CPA. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. The Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast is produced by Ide Bailey in partnership with Art Wiederman, CPA, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine, and the Academy of Dental CPAs. For audience questions and feedback, email Art Wiederman, awiederman@idebailey.com. That's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N. @EIDEBAILLY.com. Or you may call Art at 657-279-3243.